miles per hour on Sunday. Here are the numbers now. Wind south-southwest at 8. It's cloudy. 38 degrees in Racine, now 40 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Once in a while, you come across a story that is seemingly too strange, too remarkable to be true, to be real. But the story we're about to explore, in fact, is very real. It's a story told in a book called The Stranger in the Woods, the extraordinary story of the last true hermit. This is a book that explores the experience of an intriguing gentleman by the name of Christopher Knight, who lived for more than a quarter of a century the life of a hermit, but so much more so than anything you would immediately imagine. And we're going to let Michael Finkel describe in a little more detail just the extent to which Michael Finkel removed himself from all human contact for such a long period of time. And this book is not only a story about Christopher Knight and why he made that choice about his own life and the way he went about living that life completely apart from sort of any normal interactions with any human beings whatsoever, but it's also a story of the relationship between the two of them. And when Christopher Knight was sort of pulled out of his hermitage very much against his will, Michael Finkel's attempts to connect with him and establish some kind of relationship with him, and ultimately finding himself able to tell Christopher's story. It is a remarkably interesting book, and Michael Finkel is a very gifted writer whose work has appeared in all kinds of places, including National Geographic, Rolling Stone, Esquire, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, and many, many other places. The Stranger in the Woods is a Vintage Books publication, a division of Penguin Random House, a bestseller now in paperback. Again, it's titled The Stranger in the Woods. Michael Finkel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
I'm very excited to be talking with you, and I really, really loved this book. You know, it's interesting. As I framed the introduction, what I basically said was, now you're going to hear this story that's so amazing, you can't believe it's true, but it really is true. And then I realized, as I was kind of listening to my own words, as I described the story of Christopher Knight, that actually somebody might hear those words and think, wait a minute, that's not such a big deal. The world is full of hermits. I mean, people who are really antisocial, incredibly private, who do not want to interact with other human beings. I mean, probably a lot of us even know people in our own lives who, at least for certain periods of time, have been, in a sense, hermits. So probably right off the bat, it's really important for us to set the record straight and help our listeners understand the extent to which Christopher Knight withdrew from human interaction. I mean, it's really to an extent that is quite uncommon, indeed quite remarkable.
I think the first thing you have to talk about is how young Chris Knight was when he left. He, at the age of 20 years old, just 2 years out of high school, he drove his car, the only car he'd ever purchased in his life, deep into the woods of Maine, his Subaru Brett, and dropped the keys in the center console. This is a 20-year-old, and with very little food and not enough camping or survival supplies, walked into the woods and was not seen again for 27 years, but it's much more than that. During that 27 years, he never had a conversation with another human being, never touched Anybody never spent any money, saw the internet, made a phone call, used an indoor toilet. He never once, and here's where we get into even more head-scratchingly difficult to believe, but it's all been as close to proved as possible. In 27 years, he not only never saw a doctor, he never got sick. And the state of Maine is unbelievably cold. The winters there are long and wet and windy. And in those 27 years, he never once lit a fire for fear that smoke would give his campsite away. That's just the surface.
Right. So that tells us this was really quite a remarkable story, not the standard story of the crabby old guy who lives at the end of the country lane who would stick a shotgun out of his front door if somebody came knocking. This is that sense of hermitage taken to a much larger degree. And I think it's intriguing, too, to think about where this occurred, and maybe to talk a little bit about the landscape of the state of Maine itself. It's one of the only states in the union I have yet to visit, and I have to say, after reading your book, it makes me very, very anxious to finally take the time to see Maine with my own eyes. Describe the topography of the heart of Maine, and in a sense, what made this one of the last places in North America where something like this could occur?
Well, first of all, you are missing something. The state of Maine is gorgeous. I'm talking to you from Montana, which is pretty unto itself. But, boy, if we had a coastline and some good seafood, then it would be perfect. And that's pretty much what Maine is. After Chris Knight abandoned his car, he wandered around the forested areas of Maine for a couple of years. And then found his hermitage. He found the place that I think everyone is looking for. What are we looking for in life? In life, liberty, in the pursuit of happiness. He found a place that made him happy. The woods of Maine can be extraordinarily thick here in the west. There's a lot of lodgepole forest, and you could see a distance in the woods. There it is like walking through a Brillo pad. But what's even more challenging is that Maine was glaciated during the last ice age. And when the glaciers retreated, they left behind oodles of large, like, automobile-sized boulders. Chris Knight found a spot. It's sort of like a natural Stonehenge of boulders, and then surrounded by dense forest, not far from other homes, mostly second homes and little cabins surrounding the lake country of central Maine, and established a campsite in this clearing and lived there for a quarter of a century undetected. And it is a remarkable spot. Briefly, we can get into his thieving, but he read a ton of books and magazines, and sometimes when he was finished with them, he would wrap them in electrical tape and bury these sort of cinder block shaped piles just under the soil, and made a perfectly flat floor in his clearing that not only was flat but also drained rainwater. He was quite ingenious about survival methods, and tree branches linked overhead to make sort of a roof. When the authorities searched for Chris Knight's site by air, they could not find it, and that's because it was hidden under this natural roof. And you could hear all the sounds of the forest. There was just enough of a breeze so that mosquitoes didn't swarm your face, and not so much that you got frostbite in winter. And when I have three young children, and sometimes when I'm a little bit stressed and there's a couple of kids fighting and I'm in the car and I'm late to an appointment, I'm stuck in traffic and bad news pours from the radio, I think about my time at Chris Knight's site. Chris spent 10,000 nights there. I spent 7, which is the second most, but it was still magical to be there.
You could sort of understand how he would be drawn to such a place. And we should also say, maybe you said it in your description and maybe I just missed it, but that this was actually roughly a 3 to 5 minute walk from the nearest civilization. So in other words, he was not hundreds of miles away from the nearest camp or the nearest town. So it was not remote in that sense of being drastically, dramatically removed from any potential of human contact, but where he was, even relatively close to civilization in a sense, he was hidden in such a way and took such care that he was able to remain absolutely unknown for this remarkable period of time.
Yeah, it is a little bit head-scratchy how he could be so secluded and yet not far away at all. And though his hermitage was the strictest, I mentioned no conversation, no phone call, no anything, he has contradictions like we all did. In order to feed himself and for clothing and for books, he broke into many of these little cabins and a summer camp along the ponds. Now, not to excuse his behavior, and he certainly would never want his behavior excused. He had a code. He never kicked in a door or smashed a window. He would pick the front lock with a Houdini-esque sort of skill, and he would come inside and he wouldn't touch your computer or your television or your jewelry or anything like that. He would take your hamburger meat and your flashlight and probably a couple of your books. And sometimes when he would leave the cabin, he would set the door handle to lock behind him so no real thief would come in. And this was this went on for years and years and years, and some people in the community sort of intuitively understood, and some people were enraged by Chris Knight's behavior. And so the presence of the hermit there wasn't a calming influence for all people. And in fact, nobody even really knew what was going on. There was no, for most of his time, there was no clue, no pictures, no idea what exactly was happening and why items were disappearing from these cabins. Mm.
We're speaking with Michael Finkel. We're talking about his book called The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. It is the story of a young man in Maine by the name of Christopher Knight, who, in a sense, cut off all contact from the outside world, including family and his anybody who might even conceivably have been called a friend or acquaintance, and went into this self-seclusion in this hermitage in the heart of Maine and lived there, utterly unknown to the rest of the world, for 27 years. Ahead of us talking about a few more specifics of this intriguing story, I want to touch on something that you yourself say in the book, which is basically that you have kind of an understanding of where he was coming from. Not that you yourself have ever done anything remotely like this, and yet there is something about your own kind of personal makeup that, in a sense, helps you kind of understand what was driving him. Your own desire to sometimes be alone, even though you're married and you have children and a fully functioning, happy professional life. Tell us more about your own relationship with solitude and what kind of difference that made in terms of your interest in Christopher Knight and your rapport with him.
Yeah, I mean, humans are extraordinarily social creatures. Even when working on this book, I tried to ask people what was the longest you've ever been by yourself, meaning not seeing anyone, sending a text message, making a phone call. And most people, and when you're thinking about this, never pass a single day of their lives completely alone, which is startling. We don't like to be alone. The most severe non-lethal punishment in the U.S. penal system is solitary confinement. Nonetheless, there are people. Chris Knight is an outlier example, but almost all of us, as you said at the outset, do need a little downtime and alone time. And this has actually been proved scientifically. I mean, if anybody out there is a camper or spends time in nature, I bet you've noticed that you feel like you're in a better mood, a little calmer, a little more clear-headed. And this is not imaginary. Humans have been on Earth for a couple of million years, and it's only in the last 1% of our total existence on Earth that we really organized into cities and spent a lot of time crowded together. All of our senses were calibrated in the woods and the grasslands, most likely of East Africa. Really, all of our senses are calibrated to being outside in a calm and quiet environment. And it has been proven that you spend time in these environments, our levels of stress hormones go way down. The way we can fill out IQ tests go up. This has been proven in dozens of studies, and every single one has come to the same conclusion. Literally, being a little, being in solitude by yourself in a natural setting is good for you. And I guess as a writer, as part of, you know, for myself, it's part of the profession to spend a lot of time with yourself. And if you really hate to do that, I don't think you're going to make it very long as a writer, as a journalist. And of course, I interview people, I love my friends, and I have three little kids, but I crave time alone. And I find that when I don't get that, I feel a breakdown inside myself. I'm irritable, I'm not as good a father or person, et cetera. And I feel like probably most people out there could use a little bit more alone time. I'm not talking 27 years, I'm talking maybe 15 minutes a day, but I wouldn't be surprised. My advice to anybody is to do nothing, which is pretty good advice, not hard to fulfill. Try and do nothing for a tiny bit of time. Maybe the temperature of the society is a little concerning to me. Maybe it'll go down a critical degree or two. We'll all sort of calm down just a touch.
Wouldn't that be nice? So, your book begins in really interesting fashion, and I really commend you for constructing the book as you do, because it's not the easiest story to tell. And in a sense, your story begins with the matter of the evidence that this as yet unknown hermit was leaving. And it was basically because of a series of break-ins that were occurring at this thing called the Pine Tree Camp, which you called the hermit's own private Costco. This is where he would go to forage, in a sense, for the things that he needed in order to sustain himself. First of all, describe what this Pine Tree Camp was. What kind of a camp was it? What kind of structures were there? Who would be living there or staying there? And then we'll talk a little bit about the way in which this mysterious hermit in Maine was making use of what was there.
The Pine Tree Camp is a camp, it looks possibly like a classic summer camp with their wooden bunkhouses and a large dining room. The only difference being there's a lot of ramps everywhere because it specializes in catering to children and adults with physical and mental disabilities. So, but other than that, it really looks like a classic sort of old-fashioned summer camp, like maybe a Wes Anderson set summer camp. And that was Chris Knight's favorite place to gather food supplies for a couple of reasons. One was that it had being a summer camp, it often housed industrial-sized portions, which were more efficient to carry back. And two, he had found on one of his thieving missions, as he called it, a key to the walk-in freezer and hid that key. He didn't walk around with a jangling keychain, but actually hid that key under a very specific rock that he knew exactly where it was and would turn that key over, be able to pick the lock to the kitchen, to the dining hall, and in the vast cavernous dining hall, in the large, you can imagine a large stainless steel, heavy camp kitchen would unlock the freezer door and fill his backpack with cheese and frozen hamburger patties and things of that nature.
Hmm. You take great pains to describe Christopher Knight as a thief, but not a vandal. Tell us more about sort of the specific choices that he made or the way in which he went about breaking into these cabins and taking what he did and in the way that he took these items.
I believe I mentioned that there to Chris Knight. Chris Knight was raised in a family of strict morals. He knew that breaking and entering was wrong. And his desire to be alone overrode that moral absolute, and it never sat easy with him as after his arrest. You know, he confessed to everything immediately. But I think I mentioned before he never broke down a door or shattered a window. He considered that the actions of a barbarian. He would pick a lock or very carefully open a window, and it's funny to read a police officer's crime report and have it note the neatness of the crime. And several officers did go so far where he would take just precise things, a couple of books, some a pair of socks, a jar of peanut butter, I remember one couple told me that they noticed that their old backpack was missing, and they were extremely upset, not about the backpack, but that is where they had kept their passports. And then they noticed in the cupboard the passports had been removed and left there in the cupboard. So this is sort of the mindset that Chris had. I think one time to get he slept on a mattress in a camping tent, and one time he did steal a mattress, and to do so he took the front door of a small cabin off its hinges so he could slide it out. The door was deadbolted in a way that he couldn't pick, and he slid it out through the hinge side of the door and then took the care and the time to make sure the door was well repaired and reattached so that the owners wouldn't have extra work to do. So they were now short one mattress.
So if there was ever a thief with a conscience, it would be Christopher Knight. Describe the sort of evolving theories that began to develop as this pattern of thievery began to make itself apparent. I mean, and the fact that, you know, we're kind of talking about different people at different times living in these cabins, so probably it took a little while before any sort of pattern would emerge. But I mean, what were some of the initial suspicions of what was going on, and then what sort of final theory began to take shape?
Right. Imagine you owned a little cabin along the pond. It's not your full-time home, and you're mostly using it on weekends in the summer and maybe sharing it with a couple of other families. You stick a couple of steaks in the freezer on a Thursday or a Friday, and you come back Saturday or Sunday for a barbecue, and the steaks are gone. And so is a flashlight that you always had kept in that certain shelf in the living room, and you had just left that Stephen King book on the nightstand, and that's gone. Very confusing, but you're not going to call the police and say, nothing in my cabin is broken, my TV's there, but dang, if I can't find my flashlight and my Stephen King novel, the police aren't going to ride over there and help you out. But you're wondering, did that other family take that? Did my son come in with his friends and eat my steaks? And you're confused, and then you have a bonfire or a barbecue with your neighbors, and everybody's missing things, and the theories range from, I wonder if there's like a gang of teenagers and their weird initiation rite is to steal something minor from a cabin and make you crazy, or there must be someone coming from out of town, or what about that guy who lives over there? He never comes to any of our parties. And nobody knew. And I'm talking, this goes on for year after year after year. People call the police do sort of half-hearted searches. They have no idea what they're even looking for. So they decide, the community, that they might as well make up something, and they made up a legendary thing. They said the person who was doing this was a hermit, and they'll call him the Hermit of North Pond. And 27 years is such a long time that little kids who grew up hearing Hermit of North Pond stories, they had kids of their own and told these stories, and this became a legend. It was like, you know, there was like the Loch Ness Monster, the Himalayan Yeti, and the Hermit of North Pond. But there were things missing, and eventually, not to get into too much detail, a local game warden became obsessed with finding out what was really going on. And using very high-tech equipment, a lot of Homeland Security stuff, basically wired up the woods and the pine tree camp and caught the hermit in the act of stealing. And the mystery of 27 years came to an end, but in a funny way. As if a brontosaurus had walked out of Loch Ness or a large hairy beast came down from Mount Everest, the truth would be much more startling than the myth. And once the guy was captured, rather than everyone in the local area saying, oh, now we understand, nobody understood that this was actually possible. A person really had lived there for 27 years, and the mystery only deepened with the capture.
One of the things that was most intriguing to me was how you described a certain period of time in which at least some of these cabin owners began to view whoever this was as not a particularly dangerous threat, and maybe even feeling some level of genuine concern for them and their well-being, and going so far as to make kind of an extraordinary gesture towards them. Do you understand the point I'm touching on here?
So, I mean, such a long period of time goes by, and the crimes are so bafflingly petty that people sort of created in their mind a picture of this person. Imagine, you know, well, it seems like only my chunky peanut butter is being stolen, not my regular. So he must like chunky peanut butter. Look, only my briefs are stolen, not my boxers. So now I know what kind of underwear he likes. And it was always minor stuff like this. And you're right. The reason as a journalist I really like this story is because there are so many different things. There's the true crime, there's the survival, there's the philosophy of a solitude, there's what happens to a guy who's sent back into society. But I really like the story of the people who lived around the lakes and their highly varied reactions. Some people, like you said, were like, I feel like this is a person, maybe a Vietnam vet or someone who just needs survival stuff, and they first would put out, some people hung a pen and a piece of paper out and said, you know, dear hermit, please give me a list of what you need. Other people put books in plastic bags and hung them on the door and were sort of helping this guy, while other people who said it wasn't really the chicken and the spatula that makes me upset, it's the loss of peace of mind, which you can't put a price tag on. There were other people who tried to booby trap their house. One man hid in the dark in the back of his house for 14 nights with a gun, hoping to end the hermit's reign violently. He never did, and the hermit never touched any of these bags of books or wrote anything on the list, and I asked him why he didn't. He saw them. And again, this is a man who went to extreme lengths to avoid, to have no interpersonal relationships at all. And to Chris Knight, the act of filling in a shopping list was basically the act of creating a relationship with someone else, however minor it was. Suddenly they were connected. He gave the list. They're going to buy it. He's going to come by and pick it up. Next thing you know, they're at each other's weddings, and, you know, who can do that? he didn't touch any of these things and continued his break-ins and frustrated a large portion of the community. And in a weird way, I wouldn't so far as to say entertained, but intrigued another part of the community.
Absolutely. That's actually, I think, probably a kind of a good way to say it. And in a sense, one can imagine the folks living in this cabin and those who lived in nearby Albion, Maine, finding a bit of excitement in this, the kind of excitement that is probably relatively rare in a community like that.
I mean, there is a sort of cachet, like I mentioned. Why do I know Loch Ness as opposed to any other lake in Scotland? Well, because of the mystery of a couple of grainy photographs that might be a stick floating there. It might be a brontosaurus. And so having this mystery man, yes, I think at least two kids wrote college papers about this. There were songs recorded before and after his capture, for sure. But there was a legend that thrived on the lake. And as I mentioned, the capture only enhanced rather than ended the mystery.
We're speaking with Michael Finkel about his book, The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. By the way, I don't think we've mentioned the fact, but it's one of those matters in which people's imaginations, of course, begin spinning, and people are imagining at one point he was nicknamed the Mountain Man, at another point nicknamed the Hungry Man. But you tell us when finally his image was actually captured on some kind of security camera. His image was seen, and people were shocked at how ordinary he looked. Explain this moment in the story.
Yeah, a lot of things Chris Knight did subvert expectations. If you're imagining, someone lives in the woods for 27 years and you're imagining, unkempt, long-haired, tattered, clothed individual, perhaps Tom Hanks at the tail end of his castaway days, Chris Knight looked nothing like that. First of all, if you have a long beard, and I love the survival aspect of this story, and I liked getting into the nitty-gritty with how did he survive, how did he even deal with water, because all water freezes for months in Maine. How did he stay warm? But for his appearance, you know, a long beard, as he told me, is terrible in winter. It just gathers too much snow. But a clean-shaven beard is also too cold. A little bit of scruff is just perfect. So before Chris Knight went on a thieving raid, he would make sure to shave himself extremely neatly, if not completely clean-shaven, shave his hair completely or a crew cut, wear nice clean clothes, which he washed in on his wash rock with a bucket of lake water. In case someone saw him, they might think, well, there's just a gentleman out for an evening stroll rather than a sneaky hermit. He thought all of this through. So he looked like the guy next door. And in fact, as the years progressed, people did install security cameras in their cabins, despite the minor aspect of the crimes. They just wanted to see who was doing this. And the first pictures, well, all the pictures were of this well-dressed, neatly groomed gentleman. And rather than helping solve the crime, people thought, well, there it is. It's obvious. Obviously, it's some guy who lives in town is coming in to rob the cabins. That's what it's been all along. They knew it wasn't the guy living in the woods. Look at these pictures. And this made the truth even more startling. The pictures did little to help ease the mystery. Also, they actually threw people off. It's funny, pictures you think would be the ultimate evidence of where someone was from, but no one could believe that this is a picture of a person who resided all the time in the woods.
There are two things we have not yet quite touched on in terms of what made it possible for him to exist in this life of hermitage for such a long time and remain essentially undetected. One of them is that he was demonstrating a very keen gift for observing people. And this is something that he shared with you once you were at a point where he was in a position to share his story with you in some depth. Just describe a bit of what kind of observations he was making, what he was watching for that would allow him to make trip after trip after trip into this camp and come away with the things he needed to survive. I mean, that would not have been possible without this keen gift for observation.
Right. I think the first thing I need to do is just back off a bit. And I remember when I first heard about Christopher Knight and people listening, this is their first few minutes, I was thinking to myself, well, this guy must just be crazy. And the way I started my relationship with him was, by the way, by writing letters, pen on paper, back and forth while he was held in the county jail. And I knew from his first letter, the way he used the language, he even had a sense of humor, his way he described things, he was clearly highly intelligent, which is a key to almost everything that he was able to accomplish, highly intelligent. And then you're thinking, oh, he must have autism, he must have some clear, diagnosable issue. No one does this. That's quote unquote normal. And he was examined by psychologists from the state of Maine. And really, no label could be applied to him. There's probably people out there thinking Asperger's clearly, but really, when you talk to the experts, they say no. Chris Knight had to plan thoroughly in advance for every winter, and they said no, that's just not an Asperger's trait. No label fit him well, and he clearly was highly intelligent, even in high school, got amazing, excellent grades, and had a good head on his shoulders for solving problems. He, remember, got no advice from an elder for his entire life after the age of 20. I'm nearly 50, and I still call my father frequently for advice. In fact, just yesterday for tax advice. And he never did this. So everything that he did in the woods was self-invented, and it worked for so long. You're talking about his observations. He didn't live far from these homes and cabins, and it's a little unsettling, but spent a lot of time watching. And I guess when you're a true loner, you don't think of like Steve and Joe and Nancy and people. He actually just was watching for patterns. This is when the car leaves. This is when the guests come. This is when the cleaning crew enters, and sort of understood these patterns and knew when no one would be there. And even then, oh, no one's ever been there for 11 consecutive weeks on a Thursday or a Wednesday. I'm going to go on a Wednesday. Even then, would make sure the obvious thing, no lights on, no cars. And because Chris Knight had a lot of time and a lot of patience, he would often sit two, three, 4 hours just to make sure there was no movement inside. He didn't want to disturb anyone, and then would pick the lock, take what he needed, lock the door behind him, and return to his campsite, which he said, you know, you could carry about 2 weeks worth of food on his back. It was a great relief to him, and then would settle into his campsite and sometimes not leave for weeks and weeks at a time.
One other aspect that is important to acknowledge is the way in which he moved around in terms of to and from that sort of natural Stonehenge, where which was, in a sense, his hideaway and where he was living. We're not going to talk too much about his ultimate apprehension when he was apprehended, but after that occurred at some point, Sergeant Hughes actually walked with Christopher Knight to the place where he was living, and he says what he witnessed was like a work of art. Talk about the way in which Christopher Knight would so carefully move so as to scarcely leave the slightest trace that he had been there.
Terry Hughes is the game warden who eventually, using a lot of his free time and a great deal of obsession, arrested the hermit. And when you meet Terry Hughes, you see a very fit, beautifully postured, you know, crew cut wearing law and order man. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And when he is the only known person, him and another arresting officer, Diane Vance, they are the only known people to have watched Chris Knight move through the woods on the night of Knight's arrest. He agreed to show them where his camp had been and where he had been living for all these 25 years. And Terry Hughes followed right behind Chris in the woods. And Terry Hughes had been a game warden for 18 years, was known for finding lost hikers, several Alzheimer's patients who had been lost in the woods, has an uncanny ability to read the forest, to walk through the forest, to observe. And it was as if he had met someone on an entirely different level. And this law and order man broke into poetry. His face, his eyes, everything changed. He told me that following Chris Knight through the woods, like you mentioned, was like a performance art. Chris Knight stepped on roots and rocks and twisted and turned. And this is thick woods. I'm a decent hiker. I sounded like a bull in a china shop. I mean, Chris Knight could duck under branches and move and never, I know this is mind-boggling, but this is right from the police, never left a footprint. Not one. He had patterns memorized for miles, would move swiftly and bound through the woods. I think Sergeant Hughes said it was like watching a cat walk through the woods. It was that quiet and that athletic. And as he said to me, after watching Chris Knight walk through the woods to his site and seeing his precise and amazingly constructed campsite made out of pieces of garbage bag and tarpaulin and just this precision sort of structure, he said, I wanted to hate this guy. Everything in my gut wanted to hate this guy. He'd stolen from a camp for disabled kids, and yet he could not. He had witnessed someone that was so far advanced in his forestry skills that he was left in awe rather than in anger.
Hmm. We're speaking with Michael Finkel about his book, The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. This gentleman in Maine by the name of Christopher Knight, who lived without any meaningful human contact whatsoever for 27 years before finally being apprehended. In the last few minutes of our conversation, I want us to talk about the experience that you had in approaching Christopher Knight. We've touched on this just a little bit, but I think this is a very intriguing part of the story that I think is worth our exploring just a little bit further. First of all, how did you first become aware of the story of this mysterious hermit from the heart of Maine? And then what drew you to reach out to him?
The first I heard of Chris Knight was just in a very small news article in a Central Maine newspaper. I read the online edition. I must have been searching around the odd corners of the internet, and I remembered vividly, and it was very short, and every line seemed less believable than the last. 27 years, no fire, no doctor, no conversation, thousands of books, and of course, I wanted to know more. I live in Montana. I spend a lot of time, as much as possible, with three children sleeping, camping out, and I love to read books. And this was like the world champion of reading books and camping out. And of course, I wanted to know more, and I kept checking back and back and back on the site. And Chris Knight is a hermit, and he said absolutely nothing. And I couldn't stop thinking about him. And one evening, there's this nice calm in my house after my children go to sleep. My wife's an early to bed person, and there's this nice calm in the early evening. And I just took out. I figured here's a guy who shunned all of the technology of the last 30 years. So maybe this is a case where you should do it the old-fashioned way. And rather than on my computer, I took out a pen, a piece of paper. And they used to have these things called envelopes and stamps, probably. Youngsters don't know those. And I mailed a letter to the Kennebec County Jail in Central Maine. And I also thought that for someone who's clearly shy and clearly not in favor of having human interaction, maybe a letter is the right way to approach someone. You can read it in your peaceful time. You can decide not to answer without any pressure. It's not like a knock on the door. Or you can answer. And to my surprise, I received a letter in return. And that was the way our relationship started. I later found out something like 500 journalists tried to get in touch. And by some combination of luck and maybe just the simple act of writing on paper, I might have been the only person to handwrite a letter. Chris Knight, my gratefulness is enormous. He chose to communicate with me. And so we started with an epistolary relationship, an old-fashioned letter writing back and forth from Montana to Maine, from jailhouse to my house. And his writing was beautiful. And as a journalist and writer, just like the police officer's hardened heart was melted watching Chris Knight walk through the woods, my concern that this was a crazy person or someone who had done something not to be respected immediately melted. He was able to express himself in few words, but very eloquently. Many of the questions, which I'm sure the people listening have in mind, like why would someone leave? Were you happy? What did you do all day? Etc. And these are all addressed, of course, in the book.
Hmm. At some point, those letters stopped, and you ultimately made the long trip to Maine and walked into that jail hoping for the opportunity to actually meet Christopher face to face. Just describe what kind of a sort of leap of faith that represented for you.
Well, as you can imagine, someone who just spent 27 years completely autonomous and free in the woods is now locked in a cage with another person. Now, Chris Knight himself would say he deserved it. He was a thief. He was guilty. But that doesn't mean he didn't suffer greatly. And as you mentioned, after exchanging letters over the course of a summer, he said that the stress of jail was too much for him. In fact, he said some heartbreaking line to the effect of, he thought he was losing his sanity more after a couple of weeks in jail than he ever did in 27 years in the woods. And he couldn't write anymore. And he said he thanked me for providing him with a momentary respite from the terrors of jail, but goodbye. And I did. I flew all the way from my journey from Montana all the way to Maine and went to the Kennebec County Jail and just went for visiting hours. And the way it works with visitors, Chris Knight had several, it's the prisoner him or herself that gets to decide whether or not to accept the visit. And I didn't know, but I figured that was the next step. And he did agree to visit. And we visited, it was non-contact. There was a big piece of plexiglass between us, and we spoke on scratchy old phone receivers. And as you might expect, it was very, very difficult to talk with Chris Knight. He didn't like to have eye contact. He spoke slowly. But when he did talk, he really, as with his letters, used precise and often relatively poetic language, and in it we ended up meeting nine different times while he was incarcerated.
Hmm. And of course, in talking with him, you began to piece together the story of when all of this began for him, the circumstances under which he quit his last job, a long drive he took down to Florida, and whatever might have occurred inside his mind, which left him then upon returning to Maine to make this abrupt break with all that he had known before. Just describe the strange matter of his vehicle. I think in some ways that gesture really helps us understand just what a decisive break from his past Christopher Knight was making.
Yeah, you have to recall that Chris Knight left the world at age 20. It's been a while since I've been 20, but I do remember it, and I was quite impetuous, and I did a lot of things that were sort of dramatic without the appropriate planning. Chris Knight had just, he graduated high school a few years before and actually was working in Massachusetts as an alarm technician, installing automobile and home alarms, and that knowledge actually came in a little handy during his hermitage. Had just purchased a new car along with his brother, co-signed the loan, a Subaru Brat. It was the most expensive thing he'd ever purchased in his life, so this isn't the sign of someone who's about to leave society. It's actually the sign of someone who plans on hanging around. But realized that he just was never happy, never comfortable being around other people. It was much worse than that. He was extraordinarily uncomfortable and realized that this was not going to go away, this condition he felt. And decided to make a radical move, drove that car deep, 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 deep into the woods of central Maine, said it was nearly out of gas. He drove it until the car was basically stuck from a dirt road to a trail to just rambling through the branches, and it was completely stuck, almost out of gas. He dropped the keys in the center console and walked off into the woods with very little supplies and no plan of what he would do, and not enough food, not warm enough clothes by any stretch of the imagination. It was as if he would just like went for a stroll in the woods and didn't come back for 27 years. And that was the last attachment to civilization, that last action of dropping the keys in the car and just leaving. And I guess that's a very hard moment to get your head around. The why he did that was, he described it as like a gravitational tug to leave the world behind. But why did he stay is even more interesting, and that is because despite the cold and the hunger and the difficulties, he told me that he found a place in the world for the first time that he was content. This campsite in the forest, not too far from these cabins, so appealed to him that he realized it was the only spot he had ever been to that made him feel calm, relaxed, at ease, peaceful, what we all look for in our own homes, and stayed not just 25 years, but planned to stay his entire life. But unfortunately, or fortunately, it's hard to know which, was arrested stealing food and forcibly removed from his hermitage.
You describe him at one point as king of his own jungle, but alone and a lost in the forest. And in describing his experience in both of those ways, we get a sense of just what a remarkable story this is and what a remarkable man this is. And more of his story, including the story of where this all ends up, is told beautifully in your book called The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. And the book is available now in paperback, vintage books from Penguin Random House. Michael Finkel, congratulations on a superb book, and thank you for joining me today on the Morning Show to talk about it. This has been a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
On Monday's Morning Show, I'm rerunning an interview from a number of years ago with Catherine Newman, the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, a very, very important and illuminating book on this important topic. In part two of Monday's Morning Show, Steven Pinker is author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It is a contention that over the long arc of world history, the preponderance of violence has actually dramatically declined in almost every respect. On Tuesday, I'm rerunning my interview with Kyle Cassidy, the author of an intriguing a book of photographs called Armed America, Portraits of Gun Owners in Their Homes. It's a way of trying to understand the wide range of people who believe strongly in ownership of guns and own guns for various reasons. On Wednesday, the last day of February, the last day of Black History Month, Isabel